Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Court silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We are going to call the first case for this morning, 03-979. Gary J. Howell versus Orrin Denami. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Denami et al. Will be Mr. Haney for 15 minutes and Mr. Halfinger representing the Wisconsin State Bar Appellate Practice Section for 10 minutes and then Mr. Longwell for 30 minutes. Counsel, Mr. Haney.
May it please the court. The trial court in this matter found that the defense of fraud and a counterclaim for fraud to be frivolous as a matter of law and assessed costs. I think that was incorrect. The facts of the matter is that Mr. Howell had a mortgage that named himself as the mortgager, and it named the Denomis as mortgagees. Papers were prepared by a third party who never met with the Denomis. It was made at the direction of Mr. Howell. At a real estate closing that took place, the Denomis received at that time none of the paperwork. And later on, when satisfaction was demanded, the Denomis were surprised because they thought that when Howell, or at least they testified, that when Howell had approached them, he had approached them with the idea that instead of financing the purchase of his home, that they would actually be buying it for him and he would buy it back later. In his pleadings, Mr. Denomi never made claim that he owned the home that Howell was living in. Obviously, as the trial court pointed out, check the title record and it shows it's in Mr. Howell's name. What was pled was that the promise that induced the Denomis to bring the $67,000 to the closing was a promise that they were going to own the house, not that they were going to be mortgagees. And none of the paperwork shows that they had that kind of agreement. There was no meeting of the minds. And the trial court said, that's a frivolous defense. And I don't believe it is. A frivolous defense, as this court has pointed out, means there's no facts, no theory of law that is sustainable under the circumstances. And ultimately, the trial court did make a determination that it made its decision because it found Mr. Denomi, who was 83 years old, they found his testimony to be confused and therefore less credible than the plaintiff's. But that means that had Mr. Denomi's testimony been found more credible, he would have prevailed. And if he would have prevailed, then his defense and counterclaim could not have been frivolous as a matter of law, as the trial court found. So I think the first thing I would ask for by this court is a return of this case to the trial court with a non-pro-tuck order striking all references to the trial court's decision that the matter was frivolous.
Counselor, as a matter of law, we determine ownership, correct?
Correct.
And in this record, it's my understanding that Mr. Denomi was not a signer to the offer to purchase. He was not a signer on the closing statement. He is not listed on the deed.
Correct.
I don't see any indicia of legal ownership in him.
And he never made a claim that he was the legal owner in any of his pleadings. The only thing he claimed in his pleadings is that he came to the closing with $67,000. Why did he do it? And he says he did it because he had been told that he was going to own the property. But he never claimed in his pleadings that he owned the property, only that the promise or the statements made to him that induced him to bring the money were fraudulent statements. Because clearly he was not the owner and he made no claim to be the owner. But there's nothing in any of the paperwork that there's the...
He made no claim to be the owner and he was fully paid for the money that he brought to the pleading, to the closing. What in the world was he counterclaiming for?
Because in the way the original agreement is set up, and even on the terms of the mortgage note, The mortgage note itself reflects basically what Mr. Yonomi was saying, that he was supposed to own the house, or at least not own the house, that he was supposed to, for a period of time, be financing this. It was a one-year mortgage note that apparently was never treated as a one-year mortgage note. It was treated later on with this amortization schedule as though it were a 30-year mortgage.
Okay, he got a promissory note that was due in 1 year, but an amortization schedule that went beyond 1 year, right?
And the payments went beyond 1 year, and satisfaction was being asked for beyond 1 year. And Mr. Yonomi, for all of this period of time, shows on his taxes, as he's collecting this money, he's reporting all of this money and he's putting down his taxes. This is rent money. I'm now losing money because I was told I was going to buy the house. I've been counting all of this money as rental income, so I've suffered a financial loss here because I'm paying taxes.
I understand the tax return and, sure. And how that, to some degree, confirms his understanding. What I cannot understand is the legal precept on which this counterclaim was brought. A counterclaim for what?
A counterclaim to be able to recoup the losses he suffered because he was under the belief, from what he was told, that he was going to be the purchaser.
What losses are those?
First of all, would be the loss that he paid because he declared the rents as income, because he has to pay tax on that. Whereas if it's just a loan that he's paying out, the only income on that loan would be the interest. He paid much more there, and he lost that. So there was a loss there. This was not a case where he's suing to own the home. If he was suing to own the home, he would have said, I own this property, and therefore I have the right to sell it. I have the right to sale proceeds. None of that's in the pleadings. The pleadings simply say that he was led to believe that the reason he was bringing the money to be there, to be at the closing, the reason he was bringing the money was so that he would be able to purchase it. And then he acted as though he was a purchaser with regard to the way he treated the money he was receiving. He suffered a loss. He wanted to be compensated. Are we talking thousands and thousands of dollars? No. We're talking probably a couple of thousand dollars at most. But to an 83-year-old gentleman whose life experiences are much different than mine and even different from many of the members of the court here, no one here is that old yet, but to him, that was a very important principle, that this is what he had been told. Now he's lost this money. There's something wrong here. It needs to be set right.
But in this lawsuit, as well as the counterclaim, there was a claim under the statutes for a satisfaction of mortgage, which he refused to give.
Yes.
How is that not frivolous?
Because he said that there was no meeting of the minds and an agreement by him to be able to be a mortgagee, and therefore he was not in a position to satisfy the mortgage. I can today walk out of here and file with the Register of Deeds a mortgage note stating that you are the mortgagee and I'm the mortgager and never tell you about it. And if you then come forward and say, wait a minute, I never made an agreement with Haney to be a mortgagee, I can say, sure you did. Here's the paper that I filed that you never signed, that you never saw before it was prepared, with terms in it that I'm saying we negotiated, even though there's no evidence you and I ever met and talked about.
So, of course, that would be fraud. The question here is there was an amortization schedule and there was a note. So in addition to the mortgage you're talking about, I'm talking about what the judge had before him.
Yes.
And so to bring a claim and say that I thought, but there was no evidence other than the impression that your client had. There was nothing else. Let me ask you, the other thing that I found curious is, if it's a rental agreement, I found curious that the payments were $600 and some and so much cents per month. I had never seen a rental agreement or heard of one where you talk about having, so many cents on the end of it. So I'm just, after looking at what the trial judge Damon had in front of him, and then the argument, you're saying he had a choice, and he should not have found that this was frivolous.
Well, the analysis for frivolous starts with what is in the claim. And in the answer itself, there's no claim of ownership to the house. And that's what the judge found to be frivolous. That's not in the answer. So in that part, the analysis there is wrong.
That was in the record, though.
Right. Well, no, it was not in the record of the trial court because the trial court judge never gave counsel an opportunity to even be able to address the motion that it was frivolous. The other part in 2 points, the one piece of evidence that is significant with regard to the Nomi's state of mind is the tax returns that they filed showing for 2 years that this money was rental income because it would have been to their benefit to be able to report it as rent. Why it's for such an odd amount of money, I don't know. That's not clear. That's not clear from the record, and that would be speculative at this point to go into that.
Isn't that the payment off the amortization schedule? Isn't that what the amortization schedule called for? Exactly.
That is. And it's not clear from the evidence that was in there, the amortization schedule was produced sometime after the closing. That was not something that was done at the closing. And I believe that came up about a year later. Because both parties, if it were indeed a one-year mortgage that Mr. Howell had knowingly agreed to, his behavior in continuing to accept these payments and declare them as rent beyond the end of 1 year shows that there's at least a question of fact as whether or not there was a meeting of the minds.
Right. Now, the reason we're talking about this, right, is because you're complaining about the costs imposed because your defense is frivolous.
Correct.
All right. Now, I want to know first, are we dealing with both trial court costs and frivolousness and appellate court costs of frivolous or just one?
We're dealing with both. And we're dealing with both the trial court there, with the appellate court.
Okay. Now, the trial court, were you given notice about frivolousness in the trial court?
The issue that whether or not it was raised in advance. And at the end of it was at the end of the testimony that the after testimony concluded, the judge made his decision that it was decided on credibility, and then at that point counsel said, I'm asking that it be declared that everything be declared frivolous, and the judge said, yes, I'm gonna do that.
Orally in court.
Orally.
There was a request for costs.
Correct.
On basis of frivolousness.
Right.
Did you get an opportunity to respond?
No.
Okay. And then so the trial court said, you're right. Did you ask to respond?
There was no opportunity to be given. The request was made. The judge said, yes, I find. How much was the money?
All right.
And that issue was raised to the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
And the Court of Appeals said, well, you told us you didn't get a chance to respond. You didn't develop that argument.
Are you saying that there was no request for attorney's fees for frivolousness in any writing before that trial?
There might have been. I am not sure. I would have to go back and relook at the record. I was not the attorney at the trial level, so I'm hesitant to make a statement on that one way or the other.
All right. So at the moment, the issue might be a trial, whether or not you got notice before this oral motion. Okay.
Yes.
Now, at the Court of Appeals, you were objecting to the frivolous finding in the trial court.
Yes.
All right. Was there a request anywhere in the Court of Appeals for frivolous?
There was a subject brought up in the brief that was filed by the respondent.
In Court of Appeals brief.
Correct. They asked to find it frivolous, and we replied in the reply brief. But had the procedure that's set forth in the statute been filed, there would have been a separate motion filed, as the statute requires, and there would have then been a response and a briefing on this, because as this Court has pointed out, very often you might toss in a brief, I think this, I think that, I think this is frivolous, and it gives no indication as to how well developed an argument really needs to be. The Court of Appeals is critical, saying the argument wasn't well developed, but it wasn't well developed when it's introduced either. And if the Court of Appeals wants to have issues succinctly and adequately addressed, they kind of can't have it both ways, where if they say, well, your response is you weren't given a chance to hear this, to be heard, we don't think that's fully developed. Well, that's the only argument there is. There's not much to develop there.
Let me just raise another question. As to frivolousness at the trial court level, right, the statutes or rules are what, 814.025 and 802.05, is that right?
Correct.
And as to frivolousness in an appellate court, it's 809.23. Is that right?
809.25 sub 3, yes.
Okay. You're aware that 814.025 and 802.05 have been changed as of this coming July?
Yes.
All right. But 809.25.3 is as it was?
Yes.
Okay. So what's your argument on 809.25.3, or is that going to be Mr. Halfinger's part?
Our positions are a little different. Mine is that the statute currently right now requires that a separate motion be filed, and it's very specific about that. In this instance, no separate motion was filed, and that is the requirement. And then there is statutes that deal with that motion practice in the appellate court, and therefore, procedurally, the issue could not be raised. Now, it also brings up the question of the so-called rule of Riley that says if a trial court claim is frivolous, then costs can be awarded on an appeal, but it's not a finding that the appeal is frivolous. At least that's what Riley originally was. What the Court of Appeals has done kind of through the years is shorthanded that and corrupting it to the point that now if you file an appeal on a matter that's declared frivolous, the appeal is now frivolous.
But that wasn't the basis for the Court of Appeals' decision, was it?
And the Riley was the basis for the Court of Appeals' decision. And
that's,
not
was
rule,
not.
And that's not the rule of Riley.
You're saying it was because when I looked at the Court of Appeals' summary disposition, I didn't see Riley cited, nor did I see that analysis.
The Court of Appeals decided that the weight and credibility of the evidence was for the trial court, and to bring that up as an appellate issue was frivolous.
Correct. And my light's on, can I just answer the question?
Of course.
And the problem with what the Court of Appeals said is that we were arguing credibility, which we weren't. We were arguing the sufficiency. We argued, in fact, that the court, this is who the court found to be credible. They found to be credible the banker who said, I never talked to the Dodomies when I wrote these papers up. I only talked to Mr. Howell. Mr. Howell, who said, you know, I didn't include the Dodomies in this transaction. So the question there is there, given the fact that with all of the documentation that shows that people are putting up $67,000 and their signature appears nowhere, and no one who drafted the papers consulted them, and they're claiming that there was no meeting of the minds, where is the sufficiency of the proof necessary to show that there was a meeting of the minds? And that sufficiency argument is not saying that the judge erred in his judgments of credibility. It's saying even taking what the judge found to be credible, that's not enough evidence to sustain this finding. And therefore the Court of Appeals, in their ruling on the idea of credibility, that was being raised. And that's not raised. That's not raised anywhere in any of the briefs that were filed by the appellant at that point.
Thank you.
Mr. Halfinger.
Hey, please, the Court, good morning. The appellate practice section of the State Bar of Wisconsin, by leave of this Court, appears as amicus curiae in the true sense or the traditional sense of that term. That is, it is not here to champion the cause of either side, but appears and participates today to address the issue that this Court added when it granted review. That is, the issue, what procedures should the Court of Appeals follow in deciding whether an appeal should be deemed frivolous under 809.25? This is an issue of substantial importance to this section's members who appear regularly in the Court of Appeals. And given their duty to advocate zealously on behalf of their clients, from time to time have to consider and at times press arguments and appellate positions that may be close to the substantive line that 809.25 puts forward. That substantive standard, of which we are all aware, essentially a two-part standard, either a bad faith prosecution of appeal to harass or otherwise injure the opposing party, or the pressing of an appeal that has no good faith basis, even a good faith basis based upon the extension, modification, or reversing of the existing law. That standard applied in the circumstances is sometimes difficult and requires careful judgment, and at times getting close to the line, when it is, there is a need to get close to the line, it is difficult to tell where that line is. 809.25 does not say much about what procedures the Court of Appeals should follow in deciding when that standard is met. Indeed, it really only says when a motion for frivolousness or sanctions can be filed, without saying even whether a motion is required. And that raises concerns, we think, about whether or not there is, in all cases, adequate notice and opportunity to be heard. One way out of that problem would be to interpret 809.25, as petitioner suggests, to require in each instance a motion to be filed by the party in whose favor the sanction would run.
Before counsel, you filed this brief last August, if I'm not mistaken. The rules have been changed as of July 1st of this year. Has the rule change altered your position any advocated in this brief?
It has not, Your Honor, I think, because as was mentioned previously, 809.25 remains the same, and the question is, at the Court of Appeals level, what notice and opportunity to be heard should be afforded before sanctions are awarded at that stage.
What kind of a hearing do you want?
The hearing is not our focus. I don't, in most, if not
in
all,
the case in which you call for a hearing.
Yes, an opportunity to be heard. I think that opportunity to be heard, quite frankly, Your Honor, in most, if not all instances, can be satisfied by affording the party an opportunity to respond in writing after it has been put plainly on notice that the court is considering, either because a party has asked it to consider in a separate motion, or because the court has issued an order to show cause why the appeal should not be held frivolous. We are not asking for some sort of full-blown evidentiary hearing at the Court of Appeals, but rather only once an adequate notice is shown, either through a motion rather than some perhaps brief comment in a brief that this is frivolous, something that is perhaps too often thrown in for strategic reasons. But when there is clear notice that the court is being asked to consider or is considering on its own that this appeal may be held to meet the frivolousness standard of 809.25, that the party be given the opportunity to respond as to why specifically the party does not believe that 809.25 substantive standard is met, why the appeal was not intended in bad faith to harass or injure, why the appeal does, in the counsel's view, in the view of the party, has a good faith basis, or a good faith basis for the extension or modification of the law.
And my assumption is that in your response, the assumption is that the two standards here of harassing or malicious, or and especially the second standard, without reasonable basis in law and equity, the second one can be done as a matter of law. You set forth legal argument, citations, if any, and the court can say, as a matter of law, at least it looks as if there's a good faith argument for extension. And you don't need an evidentiary hearing. I mean, I think it's arguable. But I'm not so sure that the standard solely for purposes of harassing or maliciously injuring might not need a hearing because, I mean, counsel's going to deny, right? This isn't for harassment or malicious injury. I did it good faith because I think my client had a cause of action. The other guy says, heck no.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Chief Justice. That is why I said in response to Justice Prosser's question that most of the time I don't think there will be a need for an evidentiary hearing. There may be some instances, specifically those instances where the contention is that this was a malicious effort to continue to injure the opposing party, that there indeed may need to be an evidentiary hearing. Perhaps that requires a remand to the trial court to conduct that hearing, and perhaps that is an area in which this court would be well served to conduct a rulemaking, to undertake rulemaking on that sort of issues. But I don't think that that's the typical, if there was a typical claim of frivolousness, that the typical claim is not the one that this appeal was intended to maliciously injure, but rather that this appeal lacked a good faith basis in law.
Mr. Helfinger, if I could, because I'm trying to understand the interplay and follow up on the Chief's question. When you look at sub 3A, if an appeal or cross appeal is found to be frivolous, the court shall award the successful party cross fees and reasonable attorney fees. Seems to be an action for the court to take. The second sentence, a motion for costs, fees, and attorney's fees under the subsection shall be filed no later than the filing of the respondent's brief, or if a cross appeal is filed no later than the filing of the cross respondent's brief. That seems to be an action for a party to take. Seems that the, am I correct in reading the statute that there's two ways the appellate court can reach the question of frivolousness? One is where a party asks for a frivolous finding. The other is where the court on its own makes the finding.
I don't read it quite that way, Justice Butler. I read the first provision that you read as setting forth the substantive standard as when it is proper for the court to enter a sanction. The court shall enter sanctions when the standard is met. I think that the subsequent provision simply says when may a party move the court to consider that substantive standard. And I think that the rule is just silent on what procedures, if any, the court may follow if the Court of Appeals, as previously ruled, is correct, that it can decide on its own to decide that the substantive standard is met and that sanctions shall be awarded.
And that's where I'm going with this, because it would seem to me, to follow up on the Chief's question, under C1, that there's some factual, that it seemed to me that that would be something that a party would have to establish. But an appellate court reading a brief and reading that which has been submitted to it, listening to any arguments that may have heard, they already have the materials, don't they? I mean, they have what they need to make that determination. What else needs to come to the court to decide whether or not under sub 2, the party or party's attorney knew or should have known that the appeal or cross-appeal was without any reasonable basis in law or equity? What else do you need?
There are certainly instances where one would look at the briefs and say, as a judge, I don't need anything else. I can tell this is frivolous. I don't want to hear anything about this. The concern that we have and the reason that we ask for a bright-line rule, which I will concede, if viewed on a case-by-case basis, we may find to be both over- and under-inclusive, is that there is a procedural fairness issue involved, even in those cases where most of us would view it as crystal clear that there was no arguable good faith basis for the appeal. And that is, we don't think that it should be, in order to guard against the first time that a counsel and the party find out that the Court of Appeals has decided to hold this matter frivolous and award sanctions is when the opinion comes out. And the opinion comes out perhaps characterizing facts or characterizing the law in a way not quite the same as counsel and the party were thinking about it. And this is the first time that that's heard about. We think it a better practice to afford the parties and counsel an opportunity before that decision is made to explain why it is they thought there was a good faith basis, why the characterization that the court has found may not be the correct one, and to address whatever concerns that the court has before moving on to the award of sanctions.
And if I could just follow up with that, in such a proceeding, who would bear the cost, the client or the attorney?
Well, I think that that is the court. I mean, there's two answers to that question, I guess. One is the court could always decide to impose fees or costs directly on the attorney if it deems it.
I'm talking about the cost of litigation.
Right.
Not the finding. The cost of litigating whether it's frivolous. Who bears the cost?
Well, in the ordinary case, the costs are – I'm sorry. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Well, why don't you look at sub B before you proceed? ...809.253B. Maybe that does answer it. Maybe it doesn't.
So B, Your Honor?
Yeah.
3B.
3B. The costs, fees, and attorney fees awarded under A, which is frivolous appeals, may be assessed fully against the appellant or cross-appellant or the attorney representing the appellant or cross-appellant, or may be assessed so the appellant or cross-appellant and the attorney each may pay a portion of the cost. Does that answer?
Well, I think that was going to be my first answer,
okay,
which is that the court certainly has the power to assess the fees and costs as it deems just as between counsel and the parties. In the absence of that, Your Honor, I think it is a matter of the contractual relationship between counsel and the party as to who those, how those fees are, awarded.
And here's where I'm getting at that. It seems to me that it may cost your client more money to litigate this issue on a matter where the court already has the information before it. That's the concern that I have is, Are we making it too difficult to make that determination if we're going under sub C2 and the court has before it that which has not been presented with any evidence to suggest that this is a viable appeal? Is it really necessary to go further?
It may be more costly, Your Honor, but given a couple of things. One is there may be instances where a party is so interested in seeking the reversal of the trial court's decision and that there is an arguable good faith basis that the party wants to proceed in the face of those costs and will pay the cost to go as far as possibly can within the confines of the ethical rules. Alternatively, the lawyer, him or herself, may decide that it's worth undertaking those costs because once having award sanctions against it, there are serious reputational costs and, quite frankly, a pride in how one does one's job that may be the case that the lawyer, him or herself, decides to undertake the cost of proceeding to try to get to try to explain to the Court of Appeals why, in his or her view, the Court of Appeals is mistaken and the case is not frivolous.
Even if you're given notice and the awards were against you and an opportunity to be heard, doesn't mean you have to take it. You can just say, I stand on my brief, period.
Yes, you could, Your Honor.
Is this section going to be seeking any rule changes of 809.25?
It is not currently considering to propose any rule changes. I think it would wait to see what the court decides to do with this issue, if anything, in this matter before undertaking that consideration.
Given the rule changes and the likelihood that counsel at trial are not going to get attorney's fees paid to the client, who the heck is going to make a motion here on appeal? I mean, I can't understand why the change in the rule has not altered at all, not one whit, the position taken by the section.
Well, I'm not sure that I completely agree that no motion will be made. But the section's larger point, I believe, Justice, is that when there is no motion, what are the proper procedures? And so if you are correct, then indeed there will be even fewer motions than there are now. I think it only magnifies the concern that the section has that there be some opportunity before sanctions are awarded for the party and counsel to respond to the Court of Appeals consideration of the sanctions issue.
And that's consistent with the safe harbor.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, it's not totally the same, but consistent that you put on notice, and if you want to proceed, put on notice, you do it at your risk.
Yes.
Okay.
There's no many more questions. I appreciate the opportunity on behalf of the section to appear before you today.
We appreciate that the section has appeared, and let me say on behalf of the court, and you can take the message back, please, that the section has been very responsive to the court in appointing pro bono counsel who have appeared and have done yeoman work and have been very effective. Win or lose, it's been very effective and helpful to the court. Thank you. Mr. Longwell, representing Mr. Howell.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. There are some things stated by Mr. Haney as factual matters, and I kind of came up here today with a philosophy that I wouldn't get into the facts very much, but some things should be brought to the court's attention. When he discussed the meeting of the minds between the parties, there were some questions from the justices about the mortgage amount, the amortization schedule, and such. The amortization schedule, as it shows from the record, was actually created at the closing. There is some question about whether the Denomis received a copy of it at the closing, but the credible testimony is that they received a copy shortly thereafter and that it was followed practically literally to the letter. The facts also show that during the approximately 2 years of the performance of this mortgage, Mr. Howell paid the real estate taxes, paid the insurance, and as he said he was going to do from the beginning, made significant renovations to the property. Mr. Howell is a carpenter by trade. He has that ability. There was also credible testimony that during the renovations, the Denomis went to Gary's house for barbecues and such and observed the renovations taking place. He never asked their permission. I don't believe he ever even consulted with them. Another question that has arisen is whether at the trial level the Denomis received any notice that damages under 814.025 were being sought. And I believe Mr. Haney correctly stated that there was mention in the complaint that attorney's fees were being charged or were being sought. At the pretrial conference, the record shows that Judge Damon rather pointedly asked Attorney Ugent what his case was and said to the effect that he had reviewed the record to date and did not see a defense case. I don't recall Attorney Ugent's answer. Then, just prior to trial, I filed a trial brief because I was obviously the attorney that tried the case. And in the trial brief, I argued for the imposition of Section 814.025 sanctions. The Denomis did not file a trial brief.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The Denomis did not file a
trial brief. The first part, what you filed.
I filed a trial brief seeking, among other things, Section 814.025 costs and attorney's fees.
Not by motion.
Motion?
No, I don't believe I did.
All right.
Did you file an exhibit, Exhibit 15, that was the cost of attorney's fees? In the transcript that is submitted, a portion of the transcript that is in the appendix, it makes some reference to Exhibit 15 in attorney's fees that the trial judge awarded, referring to an Exhibit 15.
Yes, Justice Bradley, I did.
Okay. And so that's the court had before it the amount of money that you were requesting in attorney's fees? If you recall.
I believe I did. I know I computed it, and I probably, knowing me, speculated a little bit on how long the trial was going to take. And I may have cleaned it up later a little bit to come up with the actual time. But, yes, sir, I would have been responsible for preparing that. But let me now take the State Bar Section's concerns next. After listening to the arguments of counsel and the statements from the justices, I would say, or our position is that we agree with the State Bar's position as modified by rulemaking. We don't believe that a hearing is necessary in every case, and I think this is one of the cases where a hearing before the Court of Appeals was not necessary. It may indeed be the better practice to call for briefs or put attorneys on some kind of notice. It is our position.
Hearing, you mean evidentiary hearing?
Yes, Chief Justice Abramson. That's I guess, what I'm referring to.
An evidentiary, not necessary, but you think it's better practice to give the counsel notice?
I think the better practice is, if there's any question in the Court of Appeals' minds, to give them notice and an opportunity to brief at a minimum. But I think there are cases such as this one where the appeal is so clearly frivolous, and I'm not talking about the per se rule. I'm talking about in this case where they found simply no merit in the case, that the Court of Appeals should not be denied that tool. And I guess I ask for a balancing test, because I think that it's important to look not only at the interests of attorneys in these cases. And I don't have any answers about who should bear the costs of them, but I would lean towards the offending or the erring lawyers. I look instead at the litigants. I recognize that some litigants have, what, as they commonly say, deep pockets, and are willing to litigate something far beyond its monetary value or to prove a point or to establish a precedent. I can tell you that in Galesville, Wisconsin, those clients are few and far between. My clients tend to be people to whom money is relatively tight and for whom the cost of another layer of, if not hearing, certainly briefing, could be, in the right case, a significant burden. And having known many individuals in litigation over my 28 years, I also know that litigation, especially that at the appellate level, tends to be very wearing on people, becomes very burdensome to them because of the uncertainty of result and the calls. Well, how much is this going to cost me? And when is this going to be over? And when will I get my money? You know, that's the thing that every lawyer goes through.
Mr. Longwell, when you're talking about the balancing approach, looking at the request of the appellate section of the State Bar, do you think that we should put into the balance the burden that might be added to the caseload of the Court of Appeals?
Absolutely, Justice Crooks. Absolutely. And that's one thing that troubled me, is that I don't have any good idea as to the scale of this. I don't know if the appeals court summarily reverses many cases a year or if it's relatively uncommon, but it seems to me that if there's going to be an additional layer of briefing and in a few cases an evidentiary hearing, each case is going to have some significant amount of time added to the Court of Appeals burden.
Didn't we already do that in Wyland?
Excuse me, Justice Breyer, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Didn't we already make that requirement in the Wyland case?
No, it seemed...
Maybe it was a different section involved, but the concept of notice and an opportunity to be heard before the Court of Appeals, that was just a per curiam that I think went down and said, do it. Give notice, state your reasons.
The Wyland case involved sort of a sua sponte decision by the Court of Appeals to impose costs on attorneys, and it's only a two-page order.
Maybe I'm not stating myself very clearly. That's what I hope the Court of Appeals retains the right to do, to be able to say this is completely frivolous, no need for a hearing. And as one of the justices has already observed, Justice Prosser, in many cases, when the Court of Appeals gets the, or in all cases, when the Court of Appeals gets the case, it not only has the benefit of the trial record, it has the benefit of all the briefing the parties want to have, want to present. And I think in many cases, the question is, what else is there to say?
Well, in Weiland, the Court said that, sent this matter back to the Court of Appeals, where the Court of Appeals declared the appeal to be frivolous. He sent it back and said, one, the Court of Appeals should give Attorney Groening an opportunity to be heard regarding the frivolous appeal determination, and the Court of Appeals should then make specific findings to support any conclusion that the appeal is frivolous under 809.25.3c2.
But that is not of application in every case, is my understanding?
Well, it said in that case, you got to give the attorney an opportunity to be heard, and it said in that case, follow the rule, which is make specific findings. If you're going to say it's frivolous and you're going to order costs and fees, make a finding, just like the rule says.
Well, I think
is there anything the matter with that, in your opinion?
In my opinion, there's nothing the matter with that. I think in this case, I think the way they handled it was equally credible. They made specific findings, and they found it frivolous.
Well, in this particular case, they found it frivolous as a matter of law. So there really were no factual determinations that the Court of Appeals made, right? They essentially said the weight and credibility are for the trial court, and you haven't presented any legal issues to us or any arguments to us that would overturn that sphere of decision-making, so that's kind of the end of the story.
I guess it is, Justice Rogenstein.
Could I ask you a factual question?
Yes, Justice Prosser.
When the case was appealed to the Court of Appeals, did you ask for the costs that the appeal was frivolous? I mean, did you ask the Court of Appeals for costs, or how did it come up? Was it just completely their idea, or was this an idea you planned?
I did not make a motion. I made no separate motion for it.
You just put it in your brief.
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. In your brief to the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Justice.
Thank you.
And there was a response in the reply brief why your argument that you should receive these fees was not meritorious, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Justice Rogenstein. Mr. Haney's brief on appeal raises a couple of other points that I'd like to briefly touch on. And the first is their contention that if a losing party succeeds in proving any facts that tend to support their case, that 814.025 should then be construed as not having been violated and cannot be deemed frivolous. Now, we concede, the petitioner or the respondent concedes that the petitioners did in fact prove certain points by credible testimony. They didn't do it by Mr. DeNomi because Mr. DeNomi's testimony was ruled to have been completely incredible. And Mrs. DeNomi testified briefly, and the judge, I don't believe, made any ruling on her testimony. Judge Damon found the testimony of Glenn Bromrick, the bank loan officer who closed the transaction and who generated the amortization schedule, to be credible, and Gary Hull's testimony to be credible. And we concede that they corroborate certain aspects, we think minor, of the petitioner's story. For example, Mr. Bromrick conceded that he had never met the DeNomis prior to the closing. He conceded that they brought the bulk, but not all, of the money to the closing. He testified that he was not present when the terms of the transaction were worked out. My recollection is he testified that he did not draft the documents because they were actually drafted by an attorney in La Crosse. And he was uncertain as to whether the Denomis received copies of the amortization schedule at the closing, which is what they essentially testified. However, that's about beyond certain other minor small points.
Mr. Longwell, I have a factual question.
Yes, sir.
I want to make sure I understand this correctly. You just argued that the trial court made a finding that Mr. Denomi's testimony was incredible.
That's correct.
Was it incredible, or did the trial court find that it was less credible? Makes a difference.
But it was, I understand it was incredible, to the best of my knowledge. Is it, unless I misread it. He made two comments. One of them that his testimony was confused. And the other was that, according to my reading, his testimony was incredible.
I guess I'm concerned because if that was the trial court's finding, doesn't, for an incredible finding, doesn't the evidence have to be contrary to the physical facts of nature? Isn't that the standard for incredible as a matter of law? So I think it's State versus Oliver.
I've never heard it expressed that way. I'm not saying you're wrong, Justice Butler. I'm just saying I've never heard it expressed in that fashion.
What is the import of the things that were proved by the defense at that trial?
Well, we would contend, Justice Prosser, that they are relatively minor points, that they do not go to the sum and substance of the case, which, in large part, this was a documents case, the note, the mortgage, the amortization schedule, 24 approximately monthly payments, real estate tax records, insurance payments, monthly mortgage payments, renovations, all these things. We think that's the core of the case, plus the fact that the petitioners accepted the money and contracted with an attorney, hired an attorney, to negotiate the final payoff amount. And his letters disputing the payoff amount and getting it increased, actually, were part of the record. Entered over no objection. So we think that there is adequate testimony to support that and to show that. I think I got off track. I'm not quite sure I answered your question. Here's respondent's contention on the argument over proof of facts under 814.025. If the court holds that proof of facts, relatively minor if they are, by a losing party, takes any case out of section 814.025, I think it eviscerates the intent of 814.025. You simply are saying even though you have a losing case, if you can prove something, then that's good enough, and we won't hold it to be frivolous. We don't think that's the intent of the statute, and we don't think that's good practice for the court. We don't think it would just lead to more frivolous litigation because there really would be no 814.025 sanction. Petitioner's second contention is that the evidence to show meeting of the minds is insufficient. And I don't want to repeat what has been said here, but we think there's more than adequate testimony that there was a meeting of the minds. And more to the point, full performance by Mr. Howell. And I would, again, just touch on one thing that I think is really salient, is that the petitioners received the money. The money was paid in an amount that their attorney negotiated and renegotiated. And they have, throughout this time, kept the money, never offered to refund it. To this day, we're not totally sure what they want other than more money. And
can I ask, I want to follow up Mr. Haney's point here. What was the inducement? What did the Denomis get in exchange for their $67,000? Why were they in this case at all? What's the whole purpose of their involvement?
They were able, and I'm speaking from memory now, the last time I looked, to earn approximately 7% on the promissory note.
Seven and a half.
Thank you, Justice Wilcox. They were getting a rate that was, in those, at that time, certainly significantly more than what they would get in bank CDs. That it was obvious from the proof or from the record that that's where the money was, because they brought a bank certified check for that for somewhat lesser amount. So they had every inducement to do it. And I also, I'm not sure if Mr. Haney touched on this, but there was a family relationship. Mr. DeNomi was a friend of Mr. Howell's father. And so there was knowledge back and forth, and that's why they went to cookouts at Mr. Howell's house, was because they were friends of the family.
Was there any evidence presented at trial that DeNomi's paid for insurance, paid taxes on the property, anything of that nature?
Nothing, Justice Crooks. In fact, the evidence was exactly the contrary. The evidence at trial was they'd never even inquired about such things. Mr. Howell paid all of them, and again, without looking at the entire record, I believe we demonstrated as to both the property tax insurance and the property taxes themselves were clearly paid by Mr. Howell.
I probably shouldn't ask this question, but what the heck. Mr. Ohm represented the DeNomis?
Yes, Attorney Alan Ohm of Galesville.
Is he a trial lawyer at all?
He primarily practices real estate, probate. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood your question. Mr. Ugent represented the DeNomis at trial.
Yeah.
And Mr. Ugent, Mr. Haney, I'm sure could tell you better than I.
Was there some reason why Mr. Ohm didn't represent them at trial? You can't answer that.
No, I can. Mr. Ohm was not hired to try this case. Mr. Ohm's involvement came much earlier. He was hired, the record shows, by the DeNomis, first to evict Mr. Howell. That was based on what apparently the Howells told, or the DeNomis told, Mr. Ohm. According to the testimony of Glenn Bromwick, the loan officer, when Mr. Ohm was presented with the paperwork of the transaction, he apparently consulted with the DeNomis and said, it's a mortgage, it's a loan, you don't own the place. And they then directed him to negotiate the payoff amount, which, of course, is what he did. I believe his representation stopped there.
Just one thing for the record. I was looking at the record. It wasn't incredible. It was, Judge Damon said, confusing and not credible. That's in page 106.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Wilcox. I guess I confused incredible with not credible.
Mr. Longwell, have you completed your argument?
Yes, Justice.
Are there any other questions? Mr. Longwell, this is not on the merits of the case, but I do want it clarified. There's been a lot of correspondence and communication about setting this case for hearing.
Yes.
Communication about whether there's full agreement between you and your client, Mr. Howell. Is Mr. Howell present in court?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Yeah.
My other question is, Mr. Howell aware that you are here today?
Yes.
Representing him?
Yes.
And he doesn't, that was okay with him?
I received a letter from him dated approximately March 1, pursuant to my letter sent to him perhaps a week earlier, where I said we can do the following items. And he said, in essence, and I don't have it in my file because my file's at there.
I don't want to get into the communication other than you are authorized to represent him here today.
Yes, Chief Justice Abramson, I am.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no more questions. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Longwell. Mr. Haney, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd like to touch on two points briefly, starting with a point that Justice Butler rose, and that was with regard to what the inducement was. The inducement here to enter into this is really very little. For people who have the kind of money that the Denomis had to invest, to say that taking some of that money of $67,000 and getting 7.5% on a 30-year mortgage for an 83-year-old gentleman, that's not a real good, I mean, that's not the best use of the money, that kind of money that somebody at that advanced age can make.
Counselor, wasn't it just a 30-year amortization schedule on a one-year note?
And the note had gone well beyond 1 year.
Well, it went almost 2 years.
Right.
It was a one-year note when the transaction came down. So the amortization schedule just deals with the amount of the payment. It doesn't deal with the length of the loan.
But the idea with the note, though, that it was going to be a one-year note, the fact that the Denomis continued after that point, the fact that they started an eviction proceeding, showed that they were not, they at least had in their minds something inconsistent with the fact that they were mortgagees. The other part is
also, you're bringing up this, so if you're making the argument that 7.5% interest in 2000 was not a good economic consideration, do you know what they were earning at the bank? Do you know what the money market was paying at that time?
No.
Were you aware that there were historically low interest rates?
I am. My point is, for somebody who's going to get the best enjoyment out of the use of their money, especially at that age, it may not be in terms of any type of investments at that point of time. That's kind of, I mean, the golden years where you're enjoying the fruits of your labor as opposed to continuing. Someone my age, that would be a very good investment. But somebody who's 40 years older than me, that would be a little different. But the other part, and this is important, is that there was this botched eviction attempt that happened earlier, and that's why in the pleadings there was never the claim made that the trial court found, and that was that the Denomis were claiming ownership of the property. The analysis that the trial court used in determining this was to be frivolous is supposed to start with the answer. That's what the statute requires. That's what Kelly requires. And the court found, what they found frivolous is that there's no basis for the counterclaim that they had any ownership in the house. And that's nowhere to be found in the answer. That's why the trial court erred. That's the error of the trial court. We can sit here and we can say, you know, I think it would have been a difficult case to prove because you would have had to show, I mean, first of all, there's no documents that the Denomis signed. If they're, you know, the easiest way to avoid this, and I don't know why. I was thinking about this on the way up here because, as I say, I could name any of you as a mortgagee.
Mr. Haley, let me interrupt you for a minute. Doesn't the answer and counterclaim indicate specifically that your clients believed that they were the owners of the property?
They were told that they were going to be, but they made no claim for the ownership. What they were asking for was on a fraud claim for damages that they resulted, which, as I pointed out earlier, comes from the loss, the money that they lost because they claimed this money as rent. Again, if the inducement is because they're going to be earning interest, then why, on the tax returns, which were stipulated to and found by the court to be acceptable evidence, showing their state of mind, why are they claiming that this is rental income, which is taxed at a different rate than their interest income?
Had the eviction action been brought before Judge Damon also?
Pardon?
The eviction action, was that before Judge Damon?
I don't know. I don't know if that actually went anywhere other than the fact papers were served and somebody said there's a problem here.
But weren't they claiming and bringing an eviction action that they owned the property?
I don't know that that was a court proceeding. I think that might have just been a notice that was issued by an attorney, and then the attorney was contacted, or Mr. Bromwich contacted the other attorney. I don't believe that there was a court case that was filed with that.
Just a notice to quit or pay?
I believe that's what it was, or a notice to vacate, or a notice of eviction was drafted and served. But knowing that, I mean, that was out there. And certainly, if in the answer, if they had said, we pray the court find that we're the owners of the house, or we're claiming that we own the house, no. They're saying that the promise that was made that induced them to bring money to the closing was that they were going to be the owners, not that they own the house. But that's what creates the damages they suffered. Because, again, if the inducement is this interest, then why weren't they claiming the interest as being income? Why were they claiming the entire payment as being rental income? They would have lost more.
Not if they depreciated their house. What would the rest of the taxes, tax return look like? If it was rental income, they could have depreciated the property as well.
And again, that would again show that they believed that they were the owners.
I know, but they wouldn't have lost anything. They may well have gained a whole bunch, depending on what kind of depreciation schedule their accountant used.
The tax returns are part of the record. We could look at that. I hadn't anticipated that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haney, and thank you, Mr. Longwell, for your discussion of frivolous appeals. Frivolous has been an issue that's been of concern to the court, both in cases and in rulemaking. That concludes our hearing in 03-979 FT. Thank you. I think